First, what is the master plan for meeting New Zealand's soaring electricity demands? As the transport sector decarbonises and more cars and trucks are powered by electricity, demand is expected to double over the next 30 years. At the same time, a growing number of new renewable electricity generators are wanting to connect to the national grid, run by Transpower, a grid that was built in the 40s, 50s and 60s and was designed to be unidirectional, taking energy from a small number of big generators and getting it out to consumers. So who is responsible for the big picture and coordinating how this country powers itself in a decarbonised future? Let's not even begin to talk about the new popularity New Zealand is offering for those with energy-hungry data centres. With us to discuss, two vastly experienced veterans. One in particular, Transpower's chairman Keith Turner is with us. He's a former chief executive of Meridian, a former power planning engineer and chief operating officer for what was then ECNZ, or Electricorp, all the way back in 1999. And with us also is the outgoing chief executive of Genesis Energy, Mark England, who says the country needs to develop an energy strategy. Kia ora korua, gentlemen, welcome both of you.
Good morning.
Morena, Catherine.
Right, let's begin, Keith, with the supply. It was flat for many years, sorry, with demand. It was flat for many years, and now it is not only increasing, but of course with this transition we're having, the estimate is, what, a doubling over 30 years. You're on record as saying we're on borrowed time. Could you explain?
Well, I think the borrowed time is how the system operates. I don't think we have too much of a problem meeting the growth. We're a very lucky country in many ways for energy. You compare with Japan, who has no indigenous energy. We've got a lot of indigenous energy. And most importantly, we've got some of the cheapest indigenous energy. So hydro was that was our cheap source in the 50s, 60s, 70s. It's done us fabulously well. Wind and solar have come through now as very low-cost sources of energy, and we've got a lot of both. So the future really will be powered by a growth in wind and solar, but also geothermal. You know, there's quite a lot of unexploited geothermal reserves, and geothermal is a wonderful source because it's base load. Of course, wind and solar is a bit intermittent. You can't tell what the weather's going to do, and that works well with our current hydro system, but as we get more of it, we are going to have to manage that intermittency very carefully.
So is the borrowed time a reference to the national grid? I know there's already been a big investment in it in terms of upgrading it, but are we talking about next level to get it ready for the transition?
Look, I think the borrowed time is transmission has long lead times, you know, 10 years to build a new line. And we've got a lot of plans already in place to upgrade what we've got, increase the capacity. We're going to the Commerce Commission right now about quite a big series of upgrades in the Central North Island to increase the capability of the system. But that won't be enough. There'll be a second wave of expansion needed, and we need to get in long before we know where the generation's going to appear. So this is one of the nexus of our current system. When I was planning engineer, I knew what power stations we were going to build out 15 or 20 years, and I was able to work out where we needed transmission to go with that and get a low-cost system. Now we have the generators deciding when they'll build generation, and they come along to Transpower and say, I want to connect. And it's Transpower's job to make sure the grid meets those connection requirements. And we've got to have a bit of foresight in that, and we've got to invest ahead of the game, really.
As well as new connections for the big generators, what about the concept of the two-way grid? What about these new entrants who want in and want to be supplying power? They're nowhere near as big as the big guys, but want to be part of the picture. Is the grid ready for that? What would it take to be?
I think the grid is ready for that. I mean, two-way power is not a new phenomena for the grid. I mean, yes, it was built for a unidirectional flow, but if you think about our DC link, I mean, I was a young engineer in the 70s and we designed it to go southwards because we needed power in the South Island when it's dry. It flows north when there's lots of water down there. So that's a bi-directional thing. I think the challenge is much more at the local level, where distribution companies have always been taking power from the grid and feeding it out to consumers. But now consumers are starting to build all sorts of things, you know, solar panels, they've got batteries, they're starting to connect up to electric cars. Some electric cars can inject power into the grid. Now these local distribution companies are going to be multi-directional, and it won't be a pattern that is nearly as predictable as it used to be. So the distribution companies have got a fair old challenge to understand how to manage that sort of bi-directional game.
Are those lines companies also reluctant? We saw the infamous solar tax in one area. Are they reluctant because they fear losing customers off their books, essentially? And does that make their business model unviable?
Oh, I don't think it makes their business model unviable. I mean, the ultimate service consumers want is a very reliable power supply. And you only get that by being network connected. So
they won't lose customers, but they may lose the size of those customers' bills, and they may end up paying cash back to the customer. So does that undermine their business model?
No, I don't think so. I think what will most likely happen is that they will start providing a whole new range of services for customers. So if customers want to inject power into the grid, if the generation system's a little bit short over the peak demand and there's a bunch of power needed from batteries in the customer's premises, there'll be a range of new services that distribution companies are going to have to provide. I don't think the business model for distribution is threatened at all, and they are regulated too, so we can make sure that they survive.
So what's the borrowed time that you reference specifically?
I think the borrowed time is solving the intermittency problem and solving New Zealand's dry year problem. This wonderful hydro system we have has been very low cost, but it does come with its dependence on weather. And as Mark will know, every now and then we get a dry year and we can't feed the whole system from our hydro. And that solution could take a long time to solve.
So before I come to Mark for his plan on that, what do you believe the answer is? What's your view on Onslow straight off the bat?
Look, as Transpower's chair, I don't take a position on the solution. The position I do take, though, is we need a solution, and we need to know what that solution is soon, because it may take a long time to implement. But the market, the guys who are making the big investments, the generators, also need to know what that solution's going to be so they can plan and understand the economics of their investments. I mean, we're starting to see a lot of foreign capital find a home in solar farms and wind farms in New Zealand now. So these are not the incumbents. These are foreign investors. And they need some certainty about, one, they're going to get their power away, and two, they've got a bit of an idea what the price will be.
Mark England of Genesis, departing Genesis Energy, after how many years, Mark?
6.5 years.
Pick up, because this is getting into your argument that this country needs an energy plan. Could you please explain?
Yes, well, we've been arguing this for a while, but so have others. And what we mean by an energy plan or an energy strategy is that we've thought through some of the interdependencies in the energy system. You know, the role gas plays in electricity, the role electricity plays in industry, the interplay between the grid, as you've been talking about, generation, and then what customers actually want too. So there's a few choices that need to be made, and you've touched on some of the tensions there, the tension in the distribution networks. If someone has solar panels on their roof and a battery in their garage, they don't need the distribution network as much as they did, so there's less fees coming in. But those are just the tensions that can be worked out. And then Keith has talked about, do you build the grid in advance of new generation? And that's a really difficult one. But if you look around the world, they are. And Australia is a good example. They've set out some renewable energy zones and said, we're going to build the grid first, and then the generation will come in around it. And we've talked here in the past about this first mover disadvantage, and Keith sort of touched on that too. If you build a new wind farm in New Zealand today, and you have to build a connection to the grid that exists today. So we have one example where we would have to, if we built a wind farm, we'd have to build a 20-kilometre connection to the main grid to connect it in. You have to pay for that. And ultimately, that disincentivizes you to build the wind farm because it's more expensive. So there's a few challenges. So for us, when we say energy strategy, energy plan, it's just understanding all that. And I often say, we also, as a country, need to make some choices about what we don't do as well as what we do, because in the energy system all over the world, there's so many different things out there, new technologies coming in all the time. But as a country, I think New Zealand needs to make some choices.
Well, let's talk about what the strategy would be. I think, as Keith suggested, Onslow is a biggie, and wanting to know whether or not that project is going to go ahead or whether it's just going to sit is one out and one back and be a disincentive to some of the big generators for building new supply. Tiwai is another one that's sort of never ending. What is it that? What are the questions that the generators need answered in order to know when to invest, Mark?
Yeah, well, if you take Onslow, it's like this big dark cloud hanging over the sector. So if you're thinking about building generation or thinking about how we can keep the system reliable in 2030 as we become more renewable, there's a disincentive to invest. If the government is going to build a massive pumped hydro scheme in South Island using taxpayers' money, then why would you build gas storage, for example, to ensure you can back up that intermittent wind that Keith's talked about? Why would you build a new wind farm if the wholesale price in 2030 might be completely different if Onslow's built? So we need that addressed soon and just get clarity. If it is going to be built, then the sector will adjust and adjust around it, but it's just the talk of it without actually certainty as to whether it will or won't be built that's causing the problem.
And what to do about Tiwai, because that, as we said, every few years becomes a drama. How does that impact on planning from the generator's perspective?
Yeah, I think Tiwai has been a problem my whole time here, but I think it is slowly becoming less of an issue. I'm hearing noises that Rio are looking at a longer-term plan. They're looking at committing to New Zealand for 10-plus years. And I think if we can get that certainty from Rio Tinto regarding Tiwai, then again, the industry can plan around it. I mean, business always asks for certainty. There's never perfect certainty in any industry. But if we can take away some of the big things and just lay out the roadmap for the next 10 or 15 years, then the industry can invest.
What is the gap between planned investments, in inverted commas, by generators and this need to double supply within 30 years? Now, planned can mean different things. It can mean a dart on a board, or it can mean consents have been granted. But could you give us an overview of how what's on the drawing board is getting anywhere near the trajectory we need for new supply?
So our position at Genesis, Keith will have a different view maybe, is that there are enough wind farms and solar farms being talked about today that will be, if they are built this decade, will get us towards the high 90s in terms of percent of renewable electricity. We'll talk in a minute, hopefully, about keeping that stable and low cost, which is a key point if we're going to decarbonize energy more broadly. But for electricity, we've got quite a lot in the pipeline. I think once you get beyond 2030 and you move into a world where much more electricity is moving towards industrial heat processing and transport, then there's probably a lot more work that needs to do. And I think that's where it keeps going in terms of building the grid out to enable that too.
Yeah, I think to add to that, Transpower sits there seeing all of the inquiries for new generating connections. And we have thousands of megawatts of inquiries. And we grade them between those who are just kicking the tyres, those who have got some serious money behind them and have shown intent elsewhere, and those who are quite advanced and have got resource consents. What's very clear, the projects that are planned to be built today take the supply out to 2028 or thereabouts. The projects that are in the planning stage and probably going to appear for consents would take that supply out to the mid-2030s. If you looked at all of the projects that have turned up at our door for inquiry, if they were all to happen, we'd be well out beyond 2050. So we've got a pretty big portfolio of interest for building plant. But I think the difference between my days as a planning engineer and today is that these projects can be built in a year or two. You know, you can build a solar farm. I've seen solar farms in Australia built in 9 months. And so you don't need to make a decision 10 years ahead of when you need the energy. And that's really important for generators, that they can leave their decision to the last minute and then away they go. That's why Transpower's got to be ahead of the game and the system has got to be ahead of the game.
When you look at that portfolio of possibilities, I'd be interested in past history and what percentage of that level of interest converts to an actual delivery.
Well, I think it's a little bit hard to say today because we've got a whole new bunch of investors.
Okay. But I get you.
If I were to characterise this based on my experience in Australia, and I've had the last 15 years on Australian power company boards, you know, 40% of the inquiries that turned up at Transgrid's door converted into projects. Now, that's a very high percentage, but a lot of them were funded by international capital.
Next question to someone who's self-described as an old central planner. When you've got all, do they make sense as a cohesive whole for supply, the ones you're seeing?
Look, there's a lot of challenges in the power system. And one, you want the cheapest sources of energy. But two, you want the right mix of plants so it's reliable. And three, you want it in the right parts of the country. And four, you don't want to disturb communities and muck up their lifestyle. And five, you want it in time. You want it reliable. They're complex interactions. And I think the market has shown the last 25 years it can do that. I think it's certainly going to test the market in the next 25 years.
But you've made the point the next 25 years looks completely different from investment in, you know, new hydro by three or four big players.
It is different because we're going to see a multitude of different projects and of different scales.
But what you've seen theoretically could be a cohesive series of new projects.
I would
characterise it
slightly differently,
yeah.
Catherine. I would say that the incentives to invest in generation are clear and they're strong,
right?
Albeit slightly perturbed by the things like Onslow and Tiwai.
Mark England, can I ask you what it would look like? And it's interesting you're departing because it takes away that argument that this is necessarily all, you know, patch protection, and he would say that, wouldn't he? From what you've learned in 6.5 years here and now heading offshore, if you looked logically at what our mix might be 10 years hence, 20 years hence, what would the mix be and why?
Yeah, so there will be a lot more wind and a lot more grid-scale solar. I came here 6 years ago as a huge fan of rooftop solar, but I've worked out that actually it's a pretty disruptive thing because, it, as Keith has said, you need the generation in the right place, and it doesn't necessarily go in the right place if you're leaving it to every consumer to choose. So I think without any material subsidies, rooftop solar will only play a small role in New Zealand over the next 10 to 20 years, but it'll play a role. But primarily grid-scale wind and grid-scale solar. However, as we get towards the high 90s of renewable electricity, if we are going to go for the bigger prize, New Zealand is going to achieve that decarbonising of energy, so through transport and industrial heat processing, it will need some thermal backup. Now, that thermal needs to be there when the wind stops blowing or when the lakes are low. And you can't change that fundamental physical weather dependency in a weather-dependent renewable system. And so to do that, New Zealand is going to need two things. It's going to need short-term peaking, meaning you can turn a power station on really quickly for an evening peak in winter when the wind drops out, and it's going to need some dry year support so you can run a power station for many weeks, maybe even months during a dry period. Those are two quite different things, but when you get towards 2030, maybe into the 2030s, and you're 95, 96, 97% renewable, they'll be used very rarely, but when they're needed, they'll be really, really needed. So I think there's three things that will make up the difference between the renewable portion and the rest, and it'll be a mixture of batteries, which can be turned on for an hour or two, gas peakers, which can be turned on for 4 hours to a day, and then either coal or biomass that can be turned on for weeks at a time when the lakes are really low in an emergency. May only be used once every 2 or 3 years, whereas at the moment it's used probably once or twice a year, but it'll be really important to be there.
Will we be able to double supply within those 30 years? And who knows, it might even need to be more, Mark, but will we be able to do that?
Well, I've seen different forecasts. I mean, the double is the top end of it. You know, there's other forecasts that say over 30 years, really, it'll be about 50 to 60%. But it's a big amount of generation. I've seen a stat that says that if you built all the new generation that New Zealand needs between now and 2050 as wind, it would still only cover about 0.25% of New Zealand's landmass. So there's plenty of space. Of course, NIMBYism and people not wanting their lives disrupted by power generation and their views blocked may be an issue for consenting, but there's plenty of space in New Zealand in a relatively low-populated country. I've been saying recently I think offshore wind's a distraction for New Zealand because it's roughly double the cost, and if you look around the world, the only place offshore wind's ever really been built is when there's been huge subsidies for it. And New Zealand has all these natural resources on land. So, yes, it can be met, and it will be.
I think Keith might be agreeing with you on that.
Indeed, I think we're a blessed country when you compare us with Japan.
our feedback, often when we talk about electricity, we get a lot of feedback from those who do have rooftop solar. Now, as technology continues to improve, and we may not even need the panels, there may just be the roof that is capable of this. And as batteries, we hope, continue to improve, is there a more optimistic role for individualised rooftop solar, either off-grid or feeding into the grid? We talked about the complications of feeding into the grid because then price comes into this and the business model of the distribution companies comes into it. But is there a more optimistic picture, Keith?
Look, I probably differ from Mark on the rooftop solar. What I watch is the research front of solar chemistry. And there's probably 40 or 50 different chemistry developments in the pipeline. And if you look at the history of solar for the last 20 years, their costs have been declining at 3 to 4% per annum. So in the makeup of a panel today, most of the cost is in the frame of the panel and the sticking it on the roof, not in the chemistry. If you can laminate roofs, if you can laminate windows, you know, it doesn't even have to be very efficient on a window because you've got such a vast area. So I think the chemistry research in solar will bring new performance to the solar market that we can't even think of. I've often tested people's thinking by saying, what if solar was 1 cent a kilowatt hour? And you'd get a radical change in the way in which it's deployed, and everybody would want a piece of it.
Well, then we're into this question of what that means for investments, including Transpower's as well, which does seem to be something we've been stuck on in the past. There's a level of certainty that we just don't seem to be able to have. There's a calculated certainty that an investor will make.
I think we're going into a system now which is not as prescribed and as lumpy and as precisely defined as it used to be. And we are dealing with uncertainty every day. We are dealing with many people making decisions, not just one. And as that plays out, you need a different way of responding to that. This is much more like a neural system than it is about a prescribed single investment.
And Keith, is that a good thing, having worked in both systems? Because for a time we talked about going back to having a single buyer. NZ Power was proposed, I think, by Labor in opposition a couple of terms ago. Some would like to go back to the days when you were running things at your desk. But is that... Is greater centralisation viable when we are talking about something that's becoming a neural system? Is it impossible in some ways to centrally plan this now?
Look, I think if we stay as a market, it will be impossible to centrally plan all of the power stations and transmission lines. What we will need, though, I think, is an entirely new visibility on what's happening. Uh-huh. And I think that leads to, how do we gather data on this stuff? How do we overcome the privacy protections? Because I think we're going to need data of what's happening in a battery in a household. And it's got to be aggregated right up to the system operator, who's got to balance what's going in with what's coming out perfectly every second of the day.
This brings me to another question, and I'll come to Mark on this as well, which is price, because this is a huge issue. And again, it gets back to the argument of people who want to go back to the days of, you know, ECNZ. The argument is that the system is opaque. You can never be sure about the electricity company's profits and their promises of investment, but everyone just feels like power's too expensive for a country that has so much renewable energy. What does the future look like with respect to price, Mark, including the fact that this demand is set to increase by 50% to 100% over 30 years?
Glad you brought it up. I mean, at the end of the day, there is a consumer at the end of all this. And as we build all this renewable generation and the grid, it's going to cost. And I think there needs much more discussion. There needs to be much more discussion on those consequences. I mean, even today, the price of electricity in New Zealand is affected by the cost of carbon and the emissions trading scheme. And that's a policy that's been put in place for good reason from a climate change perspective. Someone once asked me on a panel, is the government picking winners here? No, the government's picked a loser. The loser is carbon. And the market will self-sort for what the best generation is to come underneath that and displace the carbon. But that cost of carbon on electricity is flowing through to consumer bills today. If the grid is built out ahead of new generation, as Keith suggested, which I think probably might be needed, that's going to cost consumers because that's going to be passed through to consumers too. So All these things cost, and I think, as with everything around climate change, I think more discussion needs to be had around the consumer consequence for it, so everyone understands what we're going to be paying for.
Well, this brings us back to the planning in the overview, Keith. And has anyone got a grip on what's going to happen to price under the sorts of scenarios that the likes of the Climate Commission are putting out? And I'm talking specifically the price of buying a unit of electricity.
Look, price is a sensitive issue. Transpower attempts to be agnostic about yep. price. I'm going to, I mean, from my experience, and I had a big role in writing the rules for this market, so I do understand what's going on. There's a lot of uncertainty in the market at the moment. What I do know, though, is that actually the cost of solar and wind has been dropping, but our price has not been dropping. And I think there's a bit of a disconnect between what the future costs of electricity will be from solar and wind to what the forecast price might be. Now, you know, price at the generator is only one piece of the game. It's only about 40% of the bill. Transpower's price is about 10% of the bill. The distributor's price is about 30 to 40% of the bill. And the retail margin, I might have that slightly wrong, Mark will know better. And then there's a retailing cost at the end. You know, if we build the grid a bit ahead of time, it's not going to make a massive difference to overall price to the consumer. What the consumer wants the most, though, is reliability. And they don't notice electricity in their lives when it's there.
Yeah.
They certainly notice it when it's gone.
They want reliability, but they are also price conscious.
They are price conscious.
And this is the part of the system we're not talking about as we debate, because is the market going to provide this? Should there be more central involvement or whatever? The question in the whole explanation of the consequence of decarbonising, which is what Mark is getting at, is people want to know what is going to happen to price and potentially, therefore, what their options are in their own investments.
Yeah. Look, I think the market is a way of discovering the lowest cost price. When I was power planning engineer, there was one decision maker about the future of our power system. Now we've got thousands of decision makers. And if someone finds an innovation, they're in there like a robber's dog. And that's fantastic. And I think you'll see a huge innovation in the way in which we use electricity. You know, the Amazons and the Googles are bringing new tools to the consumer.
Well, let's get straight to those two as well, because there's something else happening very rapidly in this country, which is land transition. Whether it is, and there's been a focus on the highest quality soils, but you'll hear from the farming sector, believe me, I do routinely, about the conversion of our agricultural and our horticultural soils. Now, that's for housing. It's increasingly for carbon farming in the form of forestry plantations. And now we're starting to see these solar projects appear. Christchurch Airport's one is on its own land. We just were talking in Waikato about a new one that's just introduced. But at the same time, we are seeing the likes of Microsoft and Amazon come here with insatiable global appetites for power consumption. Does it make sense for us to invest in this new generation and then effectively hand it over to an international company?
Well, I think the government's work on an energy strategy is really important here, because you only have to look at energy strategy in Europe. You know, the dependence on Russian gas has created an enormous challenge for all of those countries. We're lucky we're self-contained, but we do need to think about our overall energy strategy.
We're exporting, not literally, in effect, we are exporting, and I'm not sure there's a dollar return, as there might be in a commodity export, when we produce new electricity and an international company uses it for international commerce.
Catherine, can I chime in?
Come in, Mark.
At the end of the day, it creates jobs. So if you want an industry, if you want industries in New Zealand,
New Zealand's indigenous.
Well, in building it, certainly, and maybe less so maintaining it, but there's still jobs associated with it. And so if New Zealand wants industries and jobs and a viable and vibrant economy, using New Zealand's indigenous renewable energy resources is absolutely the right thing to do.
But Mark, should that happen before we have electrified our transport fleet?
Well, it can happen at the same time. Things will happen in different time frames, but electrifying transport is going to take time. So if everyone bought a new EV today, if every new car today was an EV, it would take about 20 years to swap them out. So we're looking at a 20 to 30 year journey on EVs. It'll happen. and it's great, and it will help decarbonize New Zealand. But it doesn't mean we should trade that off with building new data centers or bringing in new industries that want to tap into that indigenous renewable resource.
Does demand side need oversight in the context of New Zealand Inc., Keith?
Look, I think, step back as a New Zealander, and I'm not sure I'd want to see this country completely covered in wind turbines to supply the data centres of the world. We do have a competitive advantage in energy. We have a lower price, and it's renewable, so those who want that service will come. I think we do need some form of oversight. And if you were sitting here today, would New Zealand back the building of a smelter and the dedication of a major hydro capacity to it when it's actually facing this rapid decarbonisation trend? And I don't know the answer to that, Catherine. Mark's right. We've got to supply jobs, but we've also got to look after our environment. And there's a difficult balance to be struck there.
Which brings us back to the need, perhaps not for one strategy, but perhaps multiple, or at least oversight, not directing, but at least knowing, to quote, who was it in the States? Knowing your unknowables.
No one knows their unknowables.
We take a punt at them anyway. Gentlemen.
We've been a little bit hands-off about trying to direct where the country goes for energy strategy. I think the government working on energy strategy is good. I think it takes a philosophical stance, though, and I'm not sure that any analysis is going to deliver that. And you need to derive that philosophy from the public, from the people of New Zealand.
The data counts, though. The data and the information.
Data and
helps
information
inform.
Is okay. Crucial.
One question at the last minute. Is the grid going to hold up with the polar blast coming tonight? Each of you, Mark England.
I can't comment on the grid. I can say there's plenty of generation in New Zealand today that should manage that no problem.
Keith?
The grid will hold out. Have we got enough generation online?
that was a big finger point.
Well, I mean, only yesterday we had a pretty tight market. And so, you know, having enough generation present is certainly always a challenge at the moment.
Look, thanks both, Mark. All the best with your career move offshore now. And thanks very much, Keith Turner, for your time as well. Mark England and Keith Turner.